Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Songkick, Notorious Markets and Nando's. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is published author Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
If you take reports and articles you've written and mash them together into a book, does that turn you from being a journalist into an author? Is that the difference?
You've got a book, it counts.
Well, that's good. I'm very excited about that. I will have to change my Twitter biog to author Chris Cook. I'm not going to do that.
But what's the Garth Marenghi thing?
I don't know.
Like writer, author, Dreamweaver.
I do use Dreamweaver, but I don't think I am a Dreamweaver.
Well, that's something to aspire to, isn't it?
It's been a very quiet week in the music business this week.
Yeah, it really has.
Unless, of course, we record this on Thursday afternoon. It goes out on Monday morning. Now something really big is going to happen
on
Friday.
That's what normally happens.
Yeah. Now I've said that. But as of this moment, it's been a really quiet week for music business news. The main thing we're going to talk about today actually happened, well, last week as we record this, so the week before last as you listen to this, but only just. But we were really thinking we might have nothing to talk about on this week's podcast. Actually, most of the interesting things that have happened this week in the music industry have involved us. Our CMU
well,
things. For example, I would say that earlier this week, I keep saying earlier this week, I'm not doing the thing ram, all right. Last week, as people hear this podcast, last week, I'm pretty sure that one of the days, pretty much everybody in the British music industry was having the same conversation. They were all discussing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And that was Andy Malt's bold decision to illustrate a story about a tedious web block injunction in the Irish courts with a picture of a brick wall.
Well, look, you need something.
It was quite an
avant-garde. I couldn't find a picture of a blockade.
Choice.
In the past, I've used just a screen grab of a site being blocked. But last time I did that, you pointed out that it was clearly a UK block and we were talking about Irish blocks. So, look, brick wall will do.
It was very interesting. It added an interesting spin to an otherwise pretty... That was our top story one day. That's how quiet this week has been in music industry news. Our top story last Wednesday was on not even a particularly landmark web block injunction in the Irish courts, because there's been previous web block injunctions. It's just the latest. Mm. But nothing else happened that day or in the previous 24 hours. So we ended up running that for our top story. And Andy thought that a picture of a brick wall. I wonder what picture you're going to use for this week's podcast. What's our main topic? Songkick's probably our main topic this week.
Yeah, I'll probably just use a picture of a brick wall.
What about, I don't know.
I just use that for everything now.
A football boot. That's called kicking. Or that's probably almost too literal for Songkick. Anyway, I look forward to seeing what...
A boot kicking a song.
...photo you go with for this podcast. But there have been some CMU stuff this week. Can I talk about the CMU stuff?
Well, as I've already referenced you as a published author, as a segue into talking about that...
We should definitely talk about The Great Escape.
...which you then veered wildly away from.
We should definitely talk about The Great Escape, then.
That is not what I want to talk about. Well, we can talk about that. But first, I want to just get your book out of the way.
Yeah, let's get the book out of the way. So regular listeners to the podcast won't remember because it was like 2 years ago. But I remember there was a couple of occasions on the podcast where I referred to the Dissecting the Digital Dollar report that CMU Insights produced for the Music Managers Forum in the UK. I referred to it as a book and you, Andy Malt, you mocked me for that. And you said it isn't a book, it's a report. So simply to deal with that issue that's been niggling with me for 2 years now, we have actually turned it. Listen, we've turned.
Slower.
I hope that works. Otherwise, there's just going to be weird silence. We have turned 3 years of Dissecting the Digital Dollar research that CMU and the MMF has done together into a book.
Yeah, a book you can buy.
You can buy from Amazon for £15. So it's basically the part one, but updated because things have changed. In fact, just as I was signing it off and finishing it, they unveiled that frickin' Music Modernization Act in America. And so then it was like, oh, God, I've got to change that to mention that. And then just as I had to sign it off again, Sony settled with 19 recordings over the sales versus license thing.
Yeah.
But fortunately, I hadn't specifically mentioned that case, although I'd sort of talked around it. But yeah, so it's all updated. It also has that transparency guide and the deals guide that we put out last year. It has the summary of all those roundtable debates that we did in 2016. And we haven't just done it to shut Andy up, although that was one of the reasons for turning it into a book. But actually, quite a few people have been asking for a print version, so it seemed like making one was a good idea. So if you want it, if you go to cmuinsights.com/digitaldollar, then from that webpage, you can link through to Amazon and buy your copy.
We'll stick a link in the show notes for this episode.
Wow,
as well.
A link in the show notes.
Because I'm sure people will be eager to buy it.
Why would they not be? That's the question I'm asking. As the book comes out, also a final little bit of Dissecting Digital Dollar stuff is going to be happening in the next few months. I mentioned that we brought out the Transparency Guide as part of this project last October, which identifies the 20 pieces of data and information that artist managers say that they need from their labels and distributors and publishers in order to properly audit and understand the streaming business. And so the next stage is MMF are now going to encourage their members to look at all the labels and distributors that they work with, so which have signed or are distributing the artists that they represent, and to see for each of those labels and distributors, well, of these 20 pieces of information, this company is giving us 6, this company is giving us 12, and so on and so forth, so that we can feed back to those companies, and also MMF can then big up the people who are being the most transparent. So that's called the Transparency Index Project. That was also announced this week. So that's almost another bit of news that's kind of us talking about ourselves. Although it's an MMF thing, so it's not just talking about ourselves.
Speaking of things that aren't just talking about ourselves, as you previously referenced, The Great Escape is happening and we are again involved.
Yes, we have made the initial announcements about the Great Escape Convention for 2018, taking place in May, as always, in Brighton. And yeah, loads of stuff happening. Obviously, there's the festival. Huge amounts of stuff happening in the festival this year. And then the convention is the programme for industry delegates. And lots of stuff happening in that as well, including the 3 CMU Insights conferences that we are presenting in 2018. For the first time, we're starting the convention the day before the festival. So the convention will actually run from Wednesday through to Saturday.
Wow.
With the CMU Insights conferences taking place on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. The first one will look at music education. The second one will look at artificial intelligence, which I actually, if you had been paying attention, told you about, because remember...
Don't say that like I remember.
Well, I'm talking to our listeners.
Because... Well, I'm sure they were paying attention as well.
That was when we were talking about the panels I'd done over at Slush Music last year in Helsinki. And one of those, you may remember, was about the technology that writes music and who owns the copyright in that. Mm. And I said at the time, we're going to carry on that conversation at The Great Escape in May. And we are, as part of our AI conference, which will also be looking at audio recognition technology and a whole load of other really interesting technologies. And then day number 3, to the Friday of Great Escape Week, is our China conference. And so we're going to be looking at the Chinese music market, both from a copyright perspective, a streaming perspective. Obviously, there was that interesting deal late last year between Tencent, one of the big streaming music companies in China, and Spotify. So we'll explain what Tencent do and the other players in the streaming market in China. We'll also look at social media in China, because it's totally different to here. And we'll look at the Chinese live circuit and the challenges of touring in that market. And I've already had some really, really interesting conversations with people who are going to be participating in that particular strand. So I can't wait to get those on stage to have that conversation.
Yeah, it's interesting because the first time we really did anything with The Great Escape, which is a very long time ago now.
Which was before we were officially organising the conference.
It was a fringe event, I think, we were doing. And you did a number of interviews, one of which with Ed Pito from Outdustry, who does lots of business in China. And back then, which is, this is more than a decade ago now, the main thrust of your interview was... how do you make money out of music in China? And the main thrust of his responses was, you can't, don't try. But now, that's all changed.
It does feel like...
Or it's changing.
Well, you're right. 10 years ago, a lot of conferences, including The Great Escape, which is why I ended up interviewing Ed Pito, did one-hour panels on China. And the general gist of all of those panels was, oh, China, massive market... opportunities are arriving there, copyright is being reformed there, we can all make a lot of money in China. But there weren't actually very many people who were actually working in that market at the time. Ed was basically doing all of those panels with someone who was actually there doing this stuff. And he had to be the person to come on and say, yeah, not yet, not quite yet. Whereas 10 years on, yes, it's still not an easy market. But there are certain companies and artists who are now getting some traction there, both in terms of reaching an audience and generating revenue. And so it feels like it is now the time, 10 years on, to actually dedicate a day to looking at that market, both the opportunities, but also the challenges that remain. So those are the CMU Insights conferences at The Great Escape. If you go to greatescapefestival.com/convention, another URL Andy will put into the set list notes this week.
You don't know that. I say what URLs go in the notes.
People will be so amazed by the photo that you choose at the top of these set list notes, they won't be even going that far down the page. But if you go to that URL, there's all the information about our stuff and also some of the other things that have already been announced that are happening as part of the convention at The Great Escape in May. You can also buy your delegates pass. Here ends the CMU plugging.
Yeah, well, enough.
No more CMU plugging on this edition of Setlist. You're not even allowed to plug signing up to the Setlist podcast at the end. That's it. We've reached our plug quota.
Right, okay. Well, that's, yeah, as you say, enough talking about ourselves. Despite, as you said at the beginning, it being a fairly quiet news week, we did find some things to talk about that aren't related to us, and here they come. So this week we're going to talk about the US government's new online piracy report and Nando's new recording studio. Told you it was a quiet news week. But first, Songkick has settled its long-running legal battle with Live Nation. And that is big news. The deal, which is reportedly worth $110 million, will see the live music giant also acquire some of the startup ticketing firm's assets.
Now, regular listeners to Setlist will know how often we reference the fact that we love a messy lawsuit. And this was a really messy lawsuit.
I mean, we have stated on the record how much we were looking forward to this getting to court and how it almost certainly would get to court because it didn't look like either side would back down. But everyone has a price.
Everyone has a price. I've been rumbling through the system for a couple of years and it was meant to get to court November time, I think, and then it got pushed back and we were told, okay, late January, he's definitely getting to court. And then this settlement happened and that is no fun at all.
No, it's not. But we're going to talk about it, so that's something. Let's have a quick recap of what's happened.
Yes, let's remind ourselves first of all that actually Songkick was created out of two businesses. There was the Songkick business, yes, which was the gig recommendations app. And then there was what was originally called CrowdSurge, which was the ticketing platform. And then in 2015, they merged to create one company. And then towards the end of 2015, this new merged company with both the gig recommendations app and the ticketing platform sued Live Nation on the grounds of anti-competitive behaviour. And the core of the case was a product that Songkick were trying to develop, because the ticketing market is very competitive. It's very hard to get into the ticketing market, even though Songkick already had one USP, which was this great gig recommendations app that people loved. But they also came up with this other product that sort of was piggybacking on the fact that secondary ticketing was becoming a big issue again. And so they started saying, well, one of the services that we offer is, you know those pre-sale campaigns you do to your mailing list and to your fan base? So before tickets officially go on sale, if you're signed up to an artist's email list or their fan club or whatever, you get to access the tickets first. Well, we can help you manage that pre-sale campaign hitting the fan base, and then we've got systems set up and expertise to ensure that those tickets don't end up with the touts, because of course touts are signed up to every artist's mailing list so that they can get access to those early tickets. And so Songkick was saying, we have this new specialism, which is pre-sale campaigns to fan base. We've got lots of things in place to stop touts from getting these tickets. And they did a few. I think they did Adele, didn't
they? Adele was the big one, yeah.
So that was a pretty big tour to be working on. And then basically what this lawsuit was saying was that this was a new product they were trying to bring to market. They were having some success, but that they felt that Live Nation, as a tour promoter and a venue owner and a ticketing company through Ticketmaster, Live Nation also has an artist management division, was interfering to try and stop this new product from succeeding by basically making it hard for the artists that they were working with, whether they were working with those artists as the promoter or the venue or as the primary ticketing seller, they were making it difficult for those artists to then work with Songkick on the pre-sale campaign. And so the basic argument Songkick had in their original lawsuit was that that was an abuse of market dominance by Live Nation, particularly in the US market. And therefore, that was anti-competitive behaviour. So in US legal jargon, it was an antitrust case. And so that was the original litigation. It then got amended quite a bit as it went through the motions. Some of the allegations around anti-competitive behaviour were taken out. Then there was a whole industrial espionage element to
it. Yeah, that was fun.
Which was where they claimed that an ex-CrowdSurge employee was now working at Ticketmaster. He still had access to stuff on Songkick's files. I mean, that basically meant he knew the URLs of where there were information about the products that Songkick were developing. So they then accused Live Nation of industrial espionage as well as the anti-competitive behaviour. So actually, the final lawsuit that was due to go to court this month was different to what they filed 2 years ago. But I think it wasn't just us who were excited about this case getting to court. Obviously, Live Nation is a very big player in music, particularly on the live side. And lots of people in the music industry are always concerned about the dominance of the big players. So Universal, I guess, on the recordings and publishing side, and Live Nation on the live side. And other people think that Live Nation is becoming too big. It keeps buying up more venues and more festivals. And they thought it would be interesting to put a spotlight on Live Nation's dominance in the market and the way it operates. Exclusivity deals are controversial, albeit quite common in the live sector. And of course, last year, Eventim, which is a big ticketing company in Germany that also has other operations in live, it came under the spotlight in German law for the exclusivity deals that it tries to do with the artists it works with. So exclusivity deals are quite common in the live sector, but nevertheless, they are controversial. And so I think lots of people were expecting, not necessarily that a big precedent would be set in this case, because if I'm being honest, I was never sure Songkick actually had that good a case. But the feeling was, even if a precedent wasn't set in this case, it would be interesting to see what we learnt about Live Nation's operations and particularly the exclusivity deals that they do. And that would be interesting to inform the debate on the dominance of big players like Live Nation and the exclusivity deals in the live sector. So this was sort of what we were expecting to come out in this court case, which we won't because of the settlement.
Yeah, because various things that were embarrassing for Live Nation had already come out in court submissions over recent months. And you have to assume that there was a lot more of that sort of thing to come had the case got to court.
Well, as you say, it's reported that the settlement that was done was worth $110 million. Now, we know that also Live Nation are acquiring some of Songkick's assets as part of that settlement.
Yes.
But the figure that's being put around is $110 million being paid by Live Nation to Songkick. That's quite a lot of money.
Especially for a company that doesn't really exist anymore.
Well, that's the other thing, isn't it? Yes, that as all of this was still going through the motions last July, the gig recommendations bit, the bit that actually I think most people associate with the Songkick brand, that was sold off to Warner Music, as was the brand. So actually, what we're calling Songkick wasn't even still called Songkick by the time all this happened. They'd given the company another sort of slightly dry corporate name. But then, after Songkick had sold off the gig recommendations app to Warner, it then shut down the ticketing platform bit in the autumn, quite overtly blaming Live Nation Ticketmaster for that happening. So you're right. Actually, the company that was still pursuing this litigation doesn't really exist anymore. They've received this payment from Live Nation. I don't know. It sort of suggests that there was $110 million worth of stuff that Live Nation didn't want discussed in court for that settlement to be reached.
Yes. And, I mean, Live Nation, obviously, people say things in court submissions, but they had sort of made comments about how Songkick's technology didn't really work properly. And then they set up their own kind of rival thing, like the Ticketmaster verified fan thing they've subsequently set up, which is sort of trying to do what Songkick was trying to do with the pre-sale thing. It's possible they just want to own, I mean, they've got the ticketing commerce platform, the anti-tout algorithm, API applications, and all of Songkick's patents. It's possible they just wanted those so that no one else could buy them, either so that no one else could set up in competition, well, so no one else could buy them and say, right, I'm going to sue you now for trying to block our new service that we've bought off the old Songkick. So it may be that Live Nation's not actually going to do anything with any of this stuff it's bought. It just doesn't want anyone else to have it.
We've talked before on the podcast about how the ticketing market is very hard to get into because you have these really big legacy players and it's getting access to tickets. If you're a startup coming to the market, you can't be a ticketing company if you haven't got tickets to sell. And assuming you're not going to be a secondary seller, so you're not going to buy them up off the primary sites, you actually want to get the tickets directly off the promoters, the artists, the venues. Well, at the grassroots level, generally that's quite easy if you have the right relationships. And a lot of grassroots artists, actually, if they've got, I don't know, 500 tickets to sell for a show, they'll divvy them up between different ticketing companies. Because if you're in more places, you're on more sites, you might sell more tickets. But once you reach a certain level, promoters tend to give large quantities of their tickets, sometimes nearly 100%, to one ticketing company, because there's certain things that the big ticketing companies can provide that a startup can't. And startups will usually say, well, actually, our app is much better and we give you all the data and it's a much more user-friendly experience. And usually they're right to say that compared to the legacy players. But what the big companies can say to promoters is, we can advance you cash. as the money comes in, we can pass it straight on to you. Even though we know if something goes wrong with the show, we will be left having to refund everybody. But we're big enough that we can take that financial risk.
Yeah, for Live Nation, for Ticketmaster, having to refund all the tickets for one show and take that hit, it's not a big deal because they've got, I mean, how many, there was something, they put out a stat recently about how many hundreds of Live Nation shows happen every single day. It's a huge amount. One show going bad is nothing to them.
So they can take that risk. And when you're a promoter, particularly on bigger shows and bigger festivals, getting access to the money ASAP is a really attractive offer. Also, there are other kickbacks that people are given. Plus, Ticketmaster and the other ticketing companies of a similar size are sitting on huge databases of music fans that they can then use as part of the marketing. So it is hard to enter the ticketing market. And a lot of the ticketing startups seem like 3 or 4 years ago, when all the entrepreneurs who wanted to do music stuff had realized that launching a streaming service was not a good idea. They also said, oh, well, we'll do ticketing. And I remember being pitched quite a lot of those from their PR people. And with all of them, it was like, this is a really hard market to get into. And if your model relies getting the big arena tours to have the scale for your business to work, that's going to be a challenge because of the dominance of a small number of legacy players. And so then you start talking in entrepreneur speak, and it's like, well, what's your exit strategy? Where do you see this business going? Because the only thing I can see that you could do and then make a big profit on this is do something really clever and quirky and then sell it to Live Nation.
Yeah.
That is the exit strategy of most, not all, but most ticketing startups. And so that was interesting when Songkick started being very vocally critical of Live Nation and subsequently suing them. It's like, yeah, you're sort of taking away your one logical exit strategy here by shouting at the people who actually you might want to sell yourself to one day, although in a perverse sort of way. That was the outcome. I don't know. I wonder what they would have got if they'd just gone and tried to sell it. Probably not 110 million. Having said that, what you don't know is the legal fees might be 109 million.
Well, yeah.
I mean, that's unlikely, but legal fees will be substantial. So it isn't always necessarily the right way to go.
No, we wouldn't necessarily recommend that ticketing startups all start suing Live Nation. But I mean, I'm not saying don't do that because, I mean, while it lasted, this one was quite enjoyable. But it does appear that that is the end of the Songkick v Live Nation story. Although, you know, we'll see if anything else comes out of it in the coming months.
I'm sure Warner Music would like us to add that although the Songkick ticketing company is now officially no more, Songkick lives on as the original gig recommendations app, which you can still use to choose shows, and then they'll link you through to other people to sell your tickets, including Ticketmaster.
Look at you doing what Warner Music wants.
Yeah.
Still to come, how you can find musical inspiration by watching some people eat chicken, plus some news in brief. But now, the US government has published its annual Notorious Markets list. This is the report that puts the spotlight on the companies and websites accused of facilitating rampant copyright infringement.
Yeah, this is now an annual event. We get this Notorious Markets list and an accompanying report once a year. It's actually put together by the United States Trade Representative, and it's really aimed at a global audience rather than at America itself,
yeah.
In that it's a list of piracy sites that the American government and really American copyright owners have issues with. And it's sort of saying to governments around the world, you should be aware that there are issues with these sites. We're not saying that they're necessarily copyright infringing under your laws, but copyright owners in America have expressed issues with these, and we wish you would do something about it. Or, in the exact words of the US Trade Representative, the aim of the report is to help governments around the world prioritise intellectual property rights enforcement efforts that protect American businesses and their workers so that they can truly make America great again. I added that last bit, but that was sort of basically what they're saying.
Now, as part of this report, the record industry gets to submit its piracy gripe list for consideration for inclusion on the final list.
Yeah, and that submission from the RIAA is public because we reported on that a couple of months back when they put it in. So we get to first of all see what piracy gripes are the record industry in America prioritising, and then subsequently, because obviously the American government is getting submissions from other people as well, what makes it through to the final Notorious Markets top 20 or however many are on the
list. And, you know, how prominently it appears on that list and in the report. Now, I think we discussed this on a previous show, but let's quickly recap. So the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America, put stream ripping sites at the top of its list of gripes in the record industry. Also, Cloudflare, which is a legitimate company, but the RIAA reckoned was helping pirates to mask their identities and locations, making it more difficult to actually track them down and combat them.
Neither of those were a surprise when the RIAA put out its list, because we know that stream ripping has come to the top of the music industry's piracy gripe list. Various people in the music business have been talking about that, obviously because of YouTube and safe harbors. Piracy doesn't come up as much as it used to, but whenever it does, the music industry tends to hone in on the stream ripping sites. And of course, the RIAA's big piracy victory in 2017 was that they sued YouTube MP3, probably the biggest stream ripping site in the world. In fact, one of the biggest websites in the world. And they managed to push it offline and sue it out of business, in essence. So we knew that stream ripping was sort of top of their agenda. And yeah, dissing Cloudflare, the RIAA have done a bit of that recently as well. Obviously, there are critics of the record industry when they bang on about stream ripping and companies like Cloudflare and their role in piracy. On the stream ripping side, some people say, well, stream ripping has legitimate uses. Someone might upload a video to YouTube that is their content and then think, oh, I need the audio file. And they could use stream ripping site to pull the audio off the video and get it as an MP3. And they're right. There are legitimate uses of stream ripping sites. I'm not sure anyone is using it for that purpose, but in theory there is. And indeed, the RIAA's criticism of Cloudflare, some people are critical of that, mainly Cloudflare, who say, we're a legitimate business. No one is saying otherwise. You know, they work with lots of massive companies all over the world, providing various different internet services. But the record industry often says to them, but in your client base, there are some piracy services. In essence, you're helping them to mask their services, hide where their servers are, and you shouldn't do that. And then Cloudflare always come back with the classic, well, it's not for you to tell us they're a piracy site. We can't cut people off on your say-so. Go get a court order and then we'll comply. So, yeah, these are ongoing conversations in the record industry regards piracy. There are arguments on both sides. But I suppose, as I said, it was no real surprise that these were the things that the record industry wanted to put on the American government's agenda. But which of those made it through to the final report?
Well, stream ripping did. And although the report does acknowledge that there are potentially legitimate uses for stream ripping sites, it still highlights that stream ripping is a problem that the music industry has brought up. And it singles out a site called Convert to MP3 as a particularly problematic one.
So that's good for Convert to MP3. We now all know that exists.
Yeah, well, it was obviously, you know, you take down YouTube MP3. There obviously were already lots more sites offering this service, and people are still going to want to use sites like that. So it's, you know, one's always going to come up, maybe more than one. They're going to grow up into the space left by the one that's been taken down.
I think the reason why they particularly honed in on this stream ripping site, because there are quite a lot out there that all got a spike after YouTube MP3 went offline, is that this site, not only does it allow you to rip the audio off a video stream and get it as an MP3, on the homepage, it then has a box within the site where you can basically search YouTube without having to leave the website. So you can go to this stream ripping site's homepage, put in the name of an artist, I don't know who, pick an artist, Katy Perry, pick another artist.
Prince.
And you put that in, and then it will give you lots of videos off YouTube, and then almost at the click of a button...
Prince probably wasn't a good example there, was he? Justin Bieber.
He's not alive anymore to keep his content off. And the heirs are arguing too much to be monitoring to YouTube every day. Okay, Justin Bieber, you search Justin Bieber, it will then say, look, here's some Justin Bieber videos on YouTube. And almost at the click of a button, you can then start ripping the audio. So I suppose by having that search box on the homepage, that makes it even harder to suggest, oh, well, the legitimate uses for this website. Because it's like, well, clearly you're not expecting somebody who owns a video, who knows the URL, to come to get the audio. You're in essence offering a free illegal MP3 download service using YouTube as your engine. So I think that's probably why they particularly picked that site out of all of the other stream ripping sites to be the one where they're basically saying to governments of the world, you should be taking action against these guys.
If you're feeling nostalgic for piracy of yore, the Pirate Bay and VKontakte, or the Kontakter, as I believe we once decided it was called, the Russian social network, both also appear in the Notorious Markets list. Although I thought that the music industry was friends with Kontakter now.
Yeah, so contactor, as you're insisting on calling it.
You can call it V-Contact if you want.
When I did that event in Kiev recently, everyone there referred to it as VK.
Well, there's also, yeah, it's VK.com, isn't it?
VK. So I'm going to go with that because it's easier to say. So yes, VK was enemy number one of the music industry. Had the RIAA been submitting to the Notorious Markets list a few years ago, actually what I'm talking about, they would have submitted to the Notorious Markets list a few years ago. So a few years ago, their submissions, VK, V-Contact, was very high up the top. So VK is basically the Facebook of Russia, massive social network in that market. And lots of people used to use VK to illegally share music across that social network. And the major record companies all sued, and they kept saying, you need to stop doing this. But eventually they settled their lawsuits. They did deals with VK, which has subsequently launched its own streaming service in a separate app, and is in theory, this only really started last year, but is in theory cracking down on the illegal distribution of music over its social network. So yeah, the music industry is now in business with VK, which means it no longer appears on the music industry's piracy gripe list. But it isn't only the music industry who get to submit to the Notorious Markets report. Hollywood also submits.
Yeah.
And as far as the movie industry is concerned, VK is still a problem.
Yeah, the movie industry is yet to do deals with VK. And although perhaps there's less music being illegally shared on there, movies are still apparently firing back and forth all over the shop.
Yeah, so in the Notorious Markets report, it basically said, we want VK and all other social networks of that kind to apply its policies to stop the illegal distribution of copyright material across the board, not just for those content owners that it happens to be in business with. Was basically what it was saying in that report. And yeah, the Pirate Bay was in there as well, sort of for old time's sake. They almost actually said that. The Pirate Bay's here for old time's sake, referencing the fact that they've been sued so many times and yet somehow they're still going.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Lifetime Achievement Award. You get to still be on this list.
As we talked about when... Actually, that was post-Slush Music as well, wasn't it? Last year on Setlist, and I had done that interview on piracy, and we talked about the stats that the anti-piracy company Muso had presented that showed that actually the illegal streaming services are on the rise. Stream ripping is still there, but old-fashioned torrent file sharing is sort of in decline. And we discussed at the time that it might ultimately get, as you've got a generation coming through who don't want MP3s. So any piracy service, whether it's torrenting or stream ripping, where the output is an MP3, I don't want an MP3. So they may all die a death anyway. And I don't know, you sort of feel with the Pirate Bay, with the music industry, obviously, officially, they still think it's evil and it should be stopped. But almost, is there an admiration that after all this time, particularly if eventually they're just going to burn themselves out and will cease to be relevant? It is quite amazing. They've been sued so many times and they are subject to like web blocks in so many countries. And yet there they are still happily going around. It did note, actually, in the Notorious Markets report, in its little Pirate Bay tribute section, that the Pirate Bay domain had wobbled quite a bit in 2017. And we know that because whenever the Pirate Bay domain wobbles, we get a flurry of traffic to our website for our most recent Has the Pirate Bay Gone Down article. And there have been a lot more of that in recent months. So I think there is a bit of wobbling. I don't know whether that's just because they're having server issues or whether there is some sort of crackdown going on. I don't know. But it did also note that in this Notorious Markets report.
But anyway, yeah, congratulations to the Pirate Bay for hanging on in there. May you stay in the piracy gripe list for many years to come. Even if it ceases to exist, I think it should still be there. Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. And first, Sajid Javid, in his new role as Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government, has announced that the Agent of Change will be adopted into the National Planning Policy Framework, which comes as a result of that previously discussed bill put forward by Labour MP John Speller. Although this is actually just the government amending an existing document.
Yeah, so Agent of Change is the principle whereby property developers putting new residential properties next to an existing music venue need to take responsibility for assuring that there are no future noise issues once new residents move in next door. There's been quite a big campaign within the UK music community to get that adopted into planning policy over the last few years. The Music Venue Trust leading in particular, but also UK Music and other music industry trade bodies getting very much involved in that. And as you say, John Speller MP proposed a very simple change to the law in Parliament at the start of the year. Lots of people from the music industry went down to Westminster to support that. But the government had sort of indicated in the past that they might do this. So you very much sensed that when that proposal was put forward and Music Venture Trust UK Music were backing it, it wasn't that they expected John Speller's legislative proposal to go through, because legislation proposed by backbench MPs very rarely does go through, but it could just push the government on to actually doing something about this, because it's such a common sense proposal. And I think there was an element of, if they could prove that there was no opposition to this, I mean, presumably some property developers don't like the idea, but they're not going to go public and say it, because it's such a common sense thing that if you put a new residential property next to an existing music venue, of course it should be your responsibility to ensure there aren't future noise issues. So by proving that there was no opposition, the government, who aren't really doing much at the moment, because the current UK government, they don't have a proper majority in the House of Commons. Brexit's just a shambles, so they're not really doing anything. So it means they can actually do something of value, get a bit of good press. So quite clever tactics, I think, on the music industry's part. Devil being the detail, of course. But certainly the Music Venue Trust have welcomed this development just as we started recording this edition.
Nearly 40 million Americans are now using smart speakers, according to new research.
Yeah, we should qualify that they surveyed, I think, just under 2,000 people, yeah. And it was a certain percentage. And when you multiply that up, it would work out at about 40 million. But still, I think it does prove that the whole smart speaker thing, and certainly, obviously, there's a choice of smart speakers for you to purchase. But it does seem, as we expected, that Amazon's Echo has certainly got the edge in the US, which means Alexa is becoming ever more dominant in controlling the lives of the average American. And I suppose what's interesting from a music perspective is that we still think that Amazon, as a late player in the streaming music market, could gain some competitive advantage if the Echo becomes the device that so many people have in their homes. And the next phase of the growth of the streaming music market probably is going to be more home-based than like smartphone-based. And so Amazon could push their services and get more subscribers through that. Although, of course, you can use Spotify with Alexa. Whereas when Apple launch their HomePod, if they ever do, it's still to come out. But there you won't be able to do voice activation with Spotify. You can on the Alexa devices with Echo. But of course, there's some clever pricing goes on, isn't there, to try and persuade people that if they only want music via their Echo, they can get streaming a lot cheaper than if they did the classic Spotify subscription. So it does still remain to be seen whether or not Amazon can claim a big chunk of the streaming music market on the back of all of this. But I think what these stats do prove is that these voice-activated home internet-connected devices are really taking off. And certainly in the US at least, and I sort of sense it's same for the UK as well, although we've not actually got firm stats on this, Amazon have got the edge.
Yeah, well, I mean, Amazon's also in the new Sonos speakers as well, so it's not just its own devices. And there was an interview in Variety with Steve Barnett, who's the CEO of Universal Music's capital division in the US, was saying that voice recognition is going to be a really big thing in the future. And, you know, Alexa's currently only available in 9 countries. When it's available in 50, you're going to see really big changes to kind of how that affects music. An interesting thing I heard recently. Matt Farley, who we've discussed many times on this show, who is a songwriter in the US who's recorded over 18,000 songs, so that you can search for lots of weird things on Spotify, and one of his songs come up. He has a lot of songs about toilets. And he's seen a big jump in revenues from one of his songs, because if you shout poop song at Alexa, she plays his song, The Poop Song, out of all the possible poop songs that it could play. And you might think, well, who's doing that? Children are doing that. I think probably the first thing any child does when an Alexa speaker comes into their house is shout, play the poop song at it. And so that's become quite a nice bit of revenue for Matt Farley.
So Alexa is the star maker of the future, providing you're willing to mainly write songs about poop.
And you've got to take on Matt Farley.
And you've got to take on Matt, who got there first.
Who is the dominant force in that field. And lastly, S Club 7's Paul Catamol has sold the Best Newcomer Brit Award he received as part of his membership of the group in 2000. It went for over £66,000, which is just daft.
Yeah, it turns out not only does S Club still have a fan, they have a very rich fan.
I think they've got quite a lot of fans, and judging by the bids on it, they several of them are quite wealthy.
In fact, it went so well, he's now auctioning off his other Brit.
Yeah, which is also looks like it's going to get even more.
So he needs the cash, basically. He was quite upfront about that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a good interview with him on the NME website where he was very open about the fact that he'd been in a touring production of Rocky Horror Picture Show. He had a back injury that knocked him out of that production for a couple of months, and then the ongoing problems with that were making it difficult for him to get work in certainly dancing. So he'd put this award up for sale, not thinking he'd get much interest in it, and yeah, it's gone for £66,000, which is enough to clear his quite substantial debts, as to be said. He reckoned half of that money would go to clearing his debts, and the other half on possibly recording an album of Motown hits.
The other interesting thing in that interview was he said that he had tried to get on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, thinking that that might make him 60 grand that he could use, but they weren't interested. He wasn't famous enough, apparently, which is quite remarkable when you see who does qualify.
Which he also noted.
To get through.
He was like, it's just friends of celebrities, cousins of celebrities, friends.
But they don't want Paul from S Club on their tedious reality show. But he doesn't need it anymore. How many Brit Awards did they win? Just the two?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's getting short of two so far. I mean, you'd probably want to hold some back for any future problems.
They must have won some Smash Hits Poll Winners Parties Awards. They were still going, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. He must have a load of stuff.
In the S Club era. So, I hope he enjoys spending his 60 grand. Hey, he could buy a copy of Dissecting the Digital Dollar from Amazon. I'm sure he would find it really interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure he would, although we did say we weren't going to do any more plugging on this episode.
Oh, sorry.
And you've just broken that. You've lost the trust of the listener.
I will do the equivalent amount less plugging on next week's set list to compensate for that plug.
Okay. Well, you can go to setlistpodcast.com and find the show notes for this episode, where you'll find links to these stories and everything we've discussed this week, which I'm not sure if that counts as plugging or not there, but... I don't know, go there anyway. And finally this week, Nando's, the chicken restaurant, has opened a recording studio. And not just a recording studio somewhere that says Nando's above the door. It's actually in one of their restaurants, the newly revamped Soho branch. It's a free-to-use studio, so long as you don't mind people watching you work while they chomp down on some cheap chicken.
Of course, they're not the first brand to think that having a recording studio might be a good little marketing spin. Red Bull's probably best known for having a recording studio, the Red Bull Studios. I was there last week doing the... Oh, no, hang on.
Stop that.
Got very close then to doing another plug. So yeah, Red Bull have their studios, although that's not in a Red Bull restaurant or a Red Bull shop.
Imagine if Red Bull restaurants were a thing.
Well, exactly. There aren't any Red Bull restaurants or shops. So it's a standalone building. So I suppose almost this is more like when record shops used to have in-store radios, like the Virgin Megastore, and actually had the studio where they did the radio station and you could look at it while you were shopping. Except it's not like that at all, because it'll be bands in there making records and it will be people eating chicken rather than choosing records.
Yeah, I guess it's a bit like when PJ Harvey recorded her last album in a glass box at Somerset House.
But less culturally substantial and worthwhile.
Yeah, and if you're in the Nando studio, you don't get to sell tickets for people to come and watch you. It's just people who are in a restaurant who can look at you. And it sounds awful.
Although you mocked this quite heavily in your write-up on it in the CMU Daily, it is the... Nando's have been doing other stuff in music, haven't they? It's not their first music.
No, they've been doing like a mentoring thing for a few years. Like they've got people like Stormzy in to mentor new artists. And this is an extension of that.
So obviously they are convinced that chicken with nasty sauces thrown on top and great music, there's obviously a synergy going on there. That's clearly what the marketing people at Nando's think. Either that or the marketing director of Nando's wished that their career had got them in the music industry rather than selling chicken.
Well, there's lots of celebrities, particularly musicians, who really talk up Nando's and they give out like, the black card, don't they, to certain celebrities. So
I don't know, I've never
chicken.
I
went once. It was chicken. It was hot.
I like chicken. I don't like nasty sauces thrown on top of chicken.
It's just the Pizza Hut of chicken, isn't it? I don't eat meat anymore either, so it's no good to me.
Do they have any veggie options? Can you just have a bucket of the sauce?
I don't think the sauce was good enough that I just want to eat that with a spoon.
You could have it on some lettuce, maybe?
Yeah, it's not tempting me so far.
Perhaps if they were to book Morrissey in to use this recording studio, the restaurant would have to go vegetarian for a week. And then everyone would have to have veggie Nandos. That would be an interesting spin.
That would be quite the marketing. I don't know if Morrissey, I don't know how enthused by that policy Morrissey would be, that Nando's was going to go veggie in one branch for like a day.
Mind you, he was struggling to find a record company, wasn't he? Although he's not working with BMG now, so he's over that period where nobody would put out his records. He might have appreciated some free studio time a couple of years ago.
Well, maybe. But anyway, new artists can apply to use this studio, which is going to be open 5 days a week.
I suppose if you are a Nando's fan, and you're right, they do exist, although we're being very dismissive of this restaurant, there are people who would be like, oh yeah, let's go and have a Nando's. Then it's free studio time. I assume you get free food as well. Surely they throw in some free Nando's chicken with the deal.
I mean, it can't cost them very much to do that. It must cost more to have a recording studio than throw a plate of chicken into the room with it.
So, yeah, providing you're not seriously veggie or vegan and pro the rights of chickens, which you probably should be, but assuming that you're not, then actually perhaps it's a better offer to artists than we have portrayed it as so far.
That said, there still is the issue of it being a studio that is on view to people in the restaurant. So, I mean, they say, don't they, that if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. And in this, you're sort of just turned into this curiosity for people having their dinner. It all seems a bit weird.
You say that, though, but what if they were to offer their studio for us to record Setlist Podcast? Would you not like to have an audience of chicken-munching people in Soho watching us chat about the music industry?
I don't even like you watching me while I'm doing this.
I think that's a brand partnership that we should pursue. I think that's an interesting thing. People could come and watch us and munch chicken. Do you know, I forgot to check on the day that we published this story, and it has to be said, if Nando's Marketing read your write-up of this announcement, there's no way they're going to be giving us any free studio time, let alone any chicken.
I don't want either of those things.
What picture did you use to illustrate this story? Was it like an umbrella?
The recording studio.
Or something. Their actual recording studio. Wow, a relevant photo to go with the story. That's quite exciting. I might go and reread the story so I can see what this studio looks like.
Yeah, well, you go and do that then, because that is all for this week on the Setlist Podcast. You should subscribe.
Oh,
that's plugging, isn't it?
It is.
Am I allowed to do that?
I don't know. Did I mention that the CMU Insights seminars return next month and we've got three on music rights and they're really good and you should check them out at cmuinsights.com.
No, you didn't mention that. It's lucky because we're not doing any more plugging. Anyway, you should subscribe to this show on Apple Podcasts so that next time one comes out, it arrives automatically. You don't have to do anything. It's just there. It's so easy and fun.
I have spoken to at least four people in the last month who have subscribed on Spotify.
Someone emailed this week, actually, from Austria. Her name's Leah Spiegel, and she thanked us for helping with her masters through this podcast, which she'd found on Spotify.
She also listens on Spotify.
So, yeah, you could subscribe to this on Spotify, and apparently people do.
Yeah, sign up there. And if, while you're listening to our podcast on Spotify, and you find yourself looking at the podcast app, and you think, I wonder how Spotify is licensed, if you buy yourself a copy of that set initial dollar, we'll tell you. That is literally the last plug. You can just do some name checks now and then we'll wrap up this edition of Setlist. This advertorial edition of Setlist.
Well, I was also going to say that to some people here, I'm preaching to the choir. You're already subscribed. You already know that it's really easy to get Setlist delivered to you automatically every week. So those people who are already subscribed, you should just go and tell your friends. Tell them all.
Yeah, we can do that because that's not us plugging. Yeah. That's you plugging.
You should plug. Tell all of your friends and then tell them again and again and again. Until they actually sign up and subscribe. Anyway, and if you want to email us, like Leah did, it can be done. You could email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.